Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Jim Shepherd is the author of 7 previous novels, most recently The Book of Aaron, and 5 story collections, including Like You'd Understand Anyway, which was a finalist for the National Book Award and won the Story Prize. His latest, Phase 6, is a gripping novel about the next pandemic that reads like a fictional sequel to our current crisis. The novel focuses on 2 characters, mainly Alec, a young boy from a small settlement in Greenland where the disease is believed to have originated, and Janine, an epidemiologist from the CDC who is dispatched to learn what she can on the ground. Again, the name of the novel is Phase 6, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Jim Shepherd back to The Book Show. Jim, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you for being here.
Joe, great to hear from you again.
So I guess this will be my first question. In reading this novel, I thought to myself, oh, Jim is showing us how the last year could have been even worse than it was.
I see that as my mission in life, Joe.
It could be that much worse. But you had this idea well before the pandemic reared its ugly head.
I did. I had it about 4 or 5 years ago when I came across a story in the newspapers about a 12-year-old boy in Siberia who contracted anthrax, which got the Russian government's attention because they hadn't had a case of anthrax in 75 years. And when they investigated, they discovered that some anthrax spores that had been dormant in a reindeer carcass frozen in the permafrost had thawed out and revivified and infected the boy. And when I put that together with the amount of mining that both the Russians and the Greenlanders have announced they're going to be doing across their northern reaches, digging up millions of tons of permafrost, I thought, well, this is not one of those if situations. This is one of those when situations. And so I did what bad career counselors tell you in high school to do, which is find something you're doing anyway and find a way to make it pay. So since I was obsessively reading about it, I thought I might as well try to write about it.
So at what stage were you in when the actual pandemic hit?
I was actually delivering the novel to Knopf. And fortunately for me, this was the only book of all of the books I've written that I've sold in advance. and the rule in advance to Knopf is I thought, well, if I'm going to spend a lot of time in Greenland, I would like it to be on somebody else's dime. So I wrote a proposal and I sent it to my editor, and my editor bought it. And then Knopf found itself, as the pandemic was fully becoming known in early March of 2020, found itself with a manuscript on its desk about a pandemic. And they then had the unenviable task of figuring out when it's a good time to publish a novel about a pandemic during a pandemic. And there was a contingent that thought, let's rush this out right away, ripped from today's headlines. And there was another contingent that said, well, no, we need to wait. No one is going to want to read about this right now. And I was asked which contingent I supported, and I said I frankly had no idea. So they ended up deciding.
You do reference several times in the novel COVID-19, so you make reference to it. So I assume there were tweaks that were made to allow for, okay, this is going on, but we also just came through COVID-19.
Obviously, if I was going to wait to publish it, I was going to have to reference COVID-19. That was step one. And so a number of tweaks were made in that regard. An even greater set of tweaks, as you might imagine, Joe, had to be made because if, in fact, one of the ways in which fiction works is we provide exposition for those things we don't know and we accelerate through the things we assume the reader does know. When I started writing the book, all of the sort of banal details, the quotidian details of what it's like to be in a pandemic were new. So I had them all in my novel. And as the world was educated the hard way about how pandemics work, more and more of those details, things like masks and things like that, could be streamlined out. And so the book, which was never very fat, got slimmer and slimmer as the editing process went along.
You write early in the novel, on average, the world encounters one new communicable disease each year as pathogens evolve by leaps and bounds in ways that enhance their durability, transmissibility, and virulence. The keys to evolutionary success, what they're learning through generations of trial and error, is how to work with their victims in order to work against them. Again, that had just happened, and yet we see a rapidity in your novel of, okay, but then that happens again.
Yeah, that's the thing about pandemics and the thing about the complacency of human political societies, right, is we always assume, well, we got through that one. I guess we don't have to worry about that anymore. When in fact, what that's telling us is there's another one coming down the road. One of the analogies that one of the epidemiologists that I talked to found its way into the book, which I thought was wonderful, was he said, imagine these pathogens as a burglar standing outside your front door, and your front door is locked, but they have a giant sack of keys, and they're just going through the keys one by one. And it's going to take a while, but they're eventually going to find the right key, essentially.
You make reference to the Churchill bug. Explain that.
The Churchill bug is something I invented. It's a comic reference to Churchill's famous remark about Russia, which was that it was a riddle wrapped up in an enigma inside a mystery. And one of the things I was interested in doing with this fictional pandemic as opposed to COVID for dramatic purposes was coming up with something where global science really didn't know what it was dealing with for quite a while. That seemed to me a much more arresting and, if not terrifying, possibility. And we've had versions of that over the years, you know, things like Legionnaire's disease, which didn't seem to be what it was at all for quite a long time. What I ended up doing was talking with a fairly brilliant epidemiologist who teaches with me on the faculty at Williams, and I sort of dumped a problem in her lap and said, if you were going to design a pathogen that would flummox investigators, what kind of pathogen would you come up with? And once I got her going on that and started bouncing ideas off her and having her bounce ideas off me, we ended up with something fiendishly complicated and a lot of fun to write in dramatic terms.
When you look at the fiendishly complicated, what research did that take on your end of learning about ultimately these two scientists from the CDC are trying to figure out, okay, what's happening?
You know, whenever I decide I'm going to do something like this, I always have that sinking feeling, having made that decision of, oh my God, do you know how much you don't know about this subject? And in this case, it was a little more staggering than usual. And I know not only did I realize, okay, you're going to need to learn a lot more about Greenland and you're probably going to need to go there, but you're also going to need to learn about epidemiology and you're starting from zero there, essentially. And you're going to need to learn about emergency medicine because one of the protagonists is going to be an ER doctor. And you're going to need to learn about how you deal with a traumatized child because somebody's going to need to call in a professional to try and get through to this child who's at the heart of the mystery. And so in each one of those cases, I had to start self-educating. And as you might guess, the epidemiological part of it was the most challenging by far. It was the time when easily the area where I would just feel over and over again like, I'm not sure I understand this. And again, I would drag it back to two of my experts, one who was the epidemiologist I mentioned earlier, a woman named Lois Banta, and another is Tom Frieden, who's an ex-head of the CDC, who a friend put me in touch with. And they were both infinitely patient in terms of going, oh, let's go back a minute. You seem to have missed a basic step here, you know, or something like that.
Mm.
And so it's essentially like, you know, being in a library with a whole lot of books, but every so often you can tiptoe across the hall and ask somebody smarter than you why you're not understanding something, you know.
Jim Shepherd is our guest. The new novel is Phase 6. It is published by Knopf. So the book begins in this little village in Greenland where there is this mining project. Those projects have expanded, and this child, Alec, is 11 years old. He's playing with a friend and comes to this spot. That's sort of the beginning of the end, isn't it?
Yeah, in this case, the novel doesn't go as far as completing the arc of the pandemic, but it certainly is describing a pandemic that's quite a bit more ferocious than COVID that we just went through. And, you know, in a lot of ways, it's not hard to see, as devastating as COVID was, any number of ways in which we dodged a bullet, both in terms of transmissibility and in terms of lethality. And we're not going to keep dodging those bullets forever. So one of the, you know, one of the ways in which we're complicit in our own destruction here is the way we keep insisting on penetrating these worlds that are going to essentially expose these new pathogens and even old pathogens to us. You know, it's one thing to have climate change going on and have these things sort of inadvertently coming about, but it's also yet another to have this kind of rapacious version of capitalism that's saying, you know, let's make sure we dig up every single wild spot on the planet, because a lot of those wild spots on the planet are wild for a reason. The last few times human beings have tried to go into them, things haven't worked out so well.
One of the things that you do in the novel that I really enjoyed is that you really just focus on this very set group of characters. You make mention, of course, of the chaos around the world, but you really do keep your eyes on what's going on with these characters.
That's really a key to my way of going about these kinds of hubristically large subjects. I very much am drawn to, for both aesthetic and political reasons, the worm's eye view, you know, the view of the people who feel like they're taking the brunt of things and they don't necessarily have very much power and they're not the, you know, the figures in control of these things. And so, you know, I figured early on that I would be focusing on the terror and the loneliness of being an index patient. You know, what would that be like to be one of the first people involved in this? But I also was just non-perverse enough to realize, well, I couldn't just do that. So I had to expand out to the CDC investigators to give the reader some kind of epidemiological notion of what was going on. But even there, I wanted to make sure that I was just dealing with the lab grunts, you know, the people who spend all of their time in the windowless rooms trying to figure out what's going on, and not dramatizing what it was like, you know, to be the person running the CDC in a situation like that. And so one of the ways of keeping control of such a centrifugal and terrifyingly large subject, for me at least, is to focus on the individual, and the focus on just a few individuals who are trying to deal with this in various strategically located spots of the narrative. So I'm glad that appealed to you. It appealed to me, too.
We meet Janine and Denise. They're the two scientists who are sent to Greenland to figure out what happens. Ultimately, it's Janine who takes Alec back to the United States to a high-security lab to figure out what's going on. And then Denise stays behind to treat the problem there and the infected in any way that she is able. So there are these two characters who are very close that are keeping contact with one another and basically reporting back to each other of what each is facing, all of it fairly gloomy.
Yeah, what I was interested in also was the way scientists, especially dedicated scientists, end up often feeling as though they not only have neglected that other part of their lives, but that they're not very good at that other part of their lives. Mm. And so Denise and Janine are both two people who feel, well, I'm not very good at relationships. And they strike up a kind of a wary and then a very intense friendship. And then they're separated. And they are keenly aware that they've been dropped into the deep end of the pool and that a whole lot depends on what they come up with. And what the distance also allowed me to do was stage their scientific back and forth, their conversations that are designed to get at the heart of the mystery for the reader, so the reader could sort of follow along on how that kind of collaborative science is sometimes done. And there too, thank God, I was able to run those kinds of exchanges past people who've actually done them so that they could get rid of anything that seemed invalid or just silly or whatever. But the sense of isolation both mitigated by a little bit by knowing that person's out there and working on the same problem, but intensified by the fact that you're all by yourself in your little spot with a lot of pressure on you, was a conflict I was very interested in.
Could you have the bureaucracies of the nations as well as the scientific community? They're breathing down their necks. You have your own family, and oh, by the way, people that you love and care about and have worked with are dying.
Right. It's about as much pressure as you can come up with, I think. And you know, the ways in which the bureaucracies and the governments bollocks everything up are so easy to predict in advance, but the intensities of it are so outrageous that I don't think there's any way of focusing on that and not having something turn into a farce or a satire or something like that. You know, if you imagine how you would try and dramatize the Republican Party's reaction to COVID, it's kind of hard to do it seriously because it's so absurd. So I spent a lot of time, as you were pointing out earlier, referring sort of glancingly to those larger forces as our protagonists are sort of aware of them. You know, every so often you check your phone and you see another stupidity. But then you go back to what you're trying to do. You know, you focus on what you need to do in front of you.
You have your character, Denise, says at one point, who would you put your money on? Humans have been around for, what, 200,000 years and bacteria for like 3.5 billion. Well, that sums it all up, doesn't it? Pretty nicely.
You know, the anthropomorphic arrogance that we have, you know, that sense we have that because we are the pinnacle of evolution in our own minds, we are more powerful than anything else, seems like one of the more easily dashable illusions. And every so often there'll be a line like that in the novel and a reader will say, oh, I never thought of it that way. And you just think, well, how much scale do you need, essentially? You know, right. We think of dinosaurs as evolutionary failures, you know, and they lasted something like 500 million years, you know.
You were talking about the Republican response, and you read about that at one point. Most governments' websites were urging calm and listing all of the measures being taken, including mask mandates and shutdowns and bans and the ongoing efforts to develop a test, while the global news outlets panicked at different volumes. Janine's recent favorite was the Fox graphic, Apocalypse 2? But all of that seemed trampled by the social media cacophony, none of which practiced or urged restraint. And then you say that the right wing alternated between claiming that there was no problem and that the problem was now under control. Right. So, yeah, we've been to this movie. And yet, in reading the novel and going through what we've just gone through and are continuing to go through, that I don't have any great feeling that that's going to change in the next extreme, horrible pandemic that may come down the line.
No, you know, there was that old philosopher who said he loved people, but it was mankind he couldn't stand. And it really feels, when we think about, you know, a lot of interviewers have asked me, you know, have we learned from COVID? And I think on the individual level, we absolutely have, right? I mean, when the next pandemic hits, everybody's going to know the drill. And you're not going to have to explain to your aunt why she needs to wear a mask or, you know, why she needs to wash her hands, that kind of thing. Governments, on the other hand, are another thing altogether, partially because the way they've evolved, they're not really designed to protect their citizens. That's not their primary priority. And so what that means is governments are going to continue to refuse to learn, and that's going to keep us vulnerable. And books like this are designed to be Cassandra-like about that, but I don't have any illusions about the power of books like this.
Also about the power of the people who are working against those making strides. I mean, as you write, and not that far from what I read, of a full brigade of the Georgia National Guard had been deployed to protect the CDC from an encircling encampment of violent protesters who refilled the camps as quickly as they were cleared. And 300 miles away in Jacksonville, a deranged libertarian attacked a hospital with automatic weapons to liberate the patients being held against their will. We're just seeing those kind of feelings and sentiments stoked and being exacerbated to a point where it doesn't seem that that goes away either.
Yeah, I think that's right. And You know, another question that I've often gotten is, what did you not predict? And while that sort of stuff seemed to me easy enough to predict in our internet age, you know, the crazed libertarian who would find a gun and go after some hospital, what I wasn't able to predict was that an entire organized political party would essentially refuse science altogether. As a viable political position, and so it actually the COVID response was in some ways more dismal than I wrote in my novel. And again, part of what saved us was that COVID itself didn't mutate in various terrifying ways. It kept threatening to. It still threatens to, but it hasn't done it yet, and that has sort of saved our bacon in a lot of ways.
Jim Shepherd is our guest. The new novel is Phase 6. It is published by Knopf. Let's talk a little bit about Alec, quite a remarkable young boy, and yet also a fairly remarkable character, I think, because he has a lot of emotions going through him, and these scientists and nurses and aides and doctors are trying to figure out how to communicate with him, and yet he's really running that show.
Yeah, I'm. You know, as you know from some of my other work, Joe, I'm very interested in that sense people have of having been complicit in other people's problems and in other people's destruction. Mm. And in this case, it seemed to me the ultimate version of that. I thought, you know, what would it be like to be that boy in Siberia, and instead of killing yourself by digging up a reindeer carcass, suppose something you dug up killed everybody you cared about. How would you deal with that? And, you know, this is ongoing negotiation, I'm sure, that I had with my lifelong Catholicism and my, you know, having been raised a Catholic. And that sense that, you know, that I think it's not an accident that there's so many Catholic writers out there. I mean, as a child, you're sort of trained in the notion that every action you take could in some ways be catastrophic or wonderful or whatever. And so the idea that you have ethical agency is drilled into you. And so I wanted to generate a narrative where this you know, poor boy, all he was doing really was exploring and looking at something that he thought was beautiful. And instead he has a, you know, he doesn't understand the science well enough to know that to be certain of what he's done, but he has a pretty good idea that he's unleashed whatever has happened. And that's a staggering burden to have to bear up under if you're 11 years old.
I hadn't thought about that until you just said it, but yes, that sort of classic Catholic guilt that you feel that I started this whole thing.
We would learn as children, about original sin. And
right.
There was such a sense of every mortal sin is this massive transgression against God and your fellow man and all this other stuff. And so you would just walk around, at least I would walk around thinking, God, what human beings are capable of. And you know, for better and for worse, that's quite a forced, precocious education.
And you think of this boy who they're working on communicating with, and yet they're also giving him toys, and he's playing in this tent that he's in. So there is the play, there's still the 11-year-old child there, but also really the key to this mystery that they're trying to solve as well.
Exactly. You know, one of the other things I've been interested in, if you're right about complicity, one of the other things you quickly move towards as a subject is the way we compartmentalize. Children can do that as well as adults, right? So there are times when you can put something out of your mind and become an 11-year-old again and play and be appreciative that somebody is paying attention to you and try to make the best of what your new bizarre situation is. But then, you know, it all comes rushing back on you as well. And so you sort of whipsaw between being a normal child and being sort of crushed by the pressure of it again.
Well, going back to an earlier question and conversation that we had, which is, I would think by looking at just these characters and not examining what is the chaos that's happening all around in any great way, you, the author, are compartmentalizing.
Absolutely. And I, the author, am avoiding any number of things that I don't do well and don't want to do at all. And, you know, that's that might be the key to a good style, right, is figuring out what you can't do and avoiding it. So that kind of big picture thing, which I make gestures towards periodically with an omniscient voice that dips in every so often, I really don't want to spend too much time doing that. I'm much more, as I said before, interested in the impact of a global pandemic on an individual than I am of, you know, a sweeping kind of long shot of crowds in the streets kind of thing. So I try to do as little of that as I possibly can. Again, avoid some aesthetic problems for myself by doing so as well, I hope.
It would seem to me that you could go down one of two paths, well, maybe a third too, but you, as a writer, where you finish a novel like this, and then, oh, by the way, basically what you've written about is coming true, and then, well, now what do I write next? So you either say, well, I have all this knowledge, maybe I'll continue this exploration, or I want to get as far away from this as I possibly can.
It's usually the latter with me.
Yeah.
I get as far away as I can in terms of time and space often, but I don't stray very far from disaster, partially because I think disaster is the seminar in which the 21st century is sort of introducing us. But I do think that I tend to come back to that as a subject. And the most, you know, once I finished the novel, I mean, again, I delivered it back in March of 2020, so once I finished that, I started work on a long short story about the Labor Day hurricane of 1935, which was maybe one of the most catastrophic the United States has ever seen, and which was really illuminating in all sorts of ways about class in America, because any number of homeless veterans had been shipped down there to the Keys to work on the highway that was being built between Miami and Key West, and they were caught directly in the path of that hurricane. That became my way of getting away from the pandemic, essentially.
Jim Shepherd's new novel is Phase 6. It is published by Knauf. Jim, a great pleasure to have you on the program again. It's always wonderful to have you here, and I thank you so much for sharing about the latest volume.
Thank you, Joe. I could do this every day with you.
Well, it's a great pleasure to speak to you. Thank you very much. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.